It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, it's my great pleasure to once again have a panel selected carefully for their ability to survive in the early parts of a winter here in Alaska. And I'm talking about Mark Kelsey, who's come all the way into the studio. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
And I'm talking about Zaz Hollander, who is out there in the world observing the snow from another perspective. Welcome, Zaz.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
So here we are for another edition of Valley Edition. And there are strange things happening. And they range in topic from something that we were just talking a little bit about, and I'd like to begin. It has to do with feral cats. And then we'll move on to Washington, D.C. and other things like that. So, Zaz, you've been observing the meeting of the Board of Fish and Game. Feral cats, should we be worried?
Feral cats, go. So, yeah, this is the Alaska. This is just the game board. So they handle wildlife issues, and they have these kind of unwieldy meetings every few years to set statewide regulations. So there's just a ton of different topics. And the meetings go for, 7 to 10 days. And so this meeting has, all kinds of kind of hardcore wildlife issues, whether you can shoot or hunt sheep from the air, or, help yourself with a cell phone. Right now they're talking about a proposal for a no hunt a buffer zone along the Taylor Highway, top of the World Highway, because apparently hunters are just shooting from the road, on the road, too close to each other, leaving gut piles. They're shooting into herds of caribou and not really knowing if they're hitting them. So there's a higher rate of injury and then leaving the animals anyway. And so, it's pretty hardcore hunting issues. But today they also decided that a pretty contentious proposal about feral cats, that there are a number of groups who favor releasing sterilized feral cats into the wild to take the burden off of shelters and to reduce the size of these giant, sometimes, feral cat colonies. We've got them here in the valley, Eagle River. They're certainly around, and certainly an Alaska problem, especially with the cold. So the game board talked for quite a while about this. They received over 100 public comments, slightly more in favor than against, if I remember right, and ultimately decided unanimously not to allow the release of sterilized feral cats into the wild, in part because of the impact that those cats have on birds and rodents and other small animals. And
what impact is that?
They kill billions of them. they are incredibly destructive. Anyone who I have a domestic cat who goes outside, and he's a killing machine. And he doesn't really need to kill wild things. He does get cat food. And so the concern with these feral cats that are living solely outside by their own devices, unless they're being fed, is that they're killing a lot of birds, and some of them may be threatened. And it's just not, for a board that decides wildlife policy, I think their direction was pretty clear. But they did make it clear that you also can't just go walking around your neighborhood shooting cats. So that's out.
Well, so was the the upside, or folks who supported the release of sterilized feral cats? What's the point of that?
Again, it's to take the burden off of shelters, so that if people can release cats, maybe that they wouldn't have to. Like the city of Houston had a fairly large feral cat colony at their animal shelter, and if you are trying to rehome these animals, it can take a really long time. Or, the sort of controversy up here in Mat-Su is that at the animal control facility, that a lot of those feral cats are deemed not adoptable for behavioral or health or other reasons, and are killed. And so, the argument is you take the feral cats out of that mix, you sterilize them, and you release them in the wild, and it's a more humane solution. And then that is that it, in itself, that concept is controversial because some people say it's really not humane to release, especially in Alaska, because it gets so cold here.
Right.
In winter, and it's not humane for other wildlife.
So was this a close decision, or did you have any sense of that?
Nope, unanimous. All seven voted against it.
Okay.
And they also, anyone who is hoping to have a lesser hedgehog tenrec, move along, because they also rejected a proposal to put that animal on the what's called the clean list, and animals that you can have in Alaska without a permit. And that does include, I have to get this right because I have one, not a pygmy hedgehog, a hedgehog. I'll just say hedgehog. That sort of the standard hedgehogs are on the clean list, but this kind of critter, which is not a hedgehog, it looks like one, I suppose, that it will not be a easy to have pet in Alaska. It will not be a legal pet to have in Alaska without a permit.
So was the Board of Game the first and only stop for this issue, or did it get referred from another state body?
Nope, this is where the proposal started and ended. And it's the first time that they've considered, I think, both of these proposals, the feral cat proposal. These proposals come up quite a bit and are in different states. Hawaii has taken a similar measure, but New Jersey has, I believe they have a bill that now requires no-kill shelters by 2025. So that's going to, I think the assumption there is that may trigger this kind of a sterilization release program. And then Illinois, I believe, also releases. It's legal to release sterilized feral cats there. And so other states have dealt with it. And yes, with the lesser hedgehog tenrec, this is the first time it's come to the board, and the board is where it started. They set the policies that the Department of Fish and Game then implement.
And just to bring listeners to the end, perhaps, of the discussion about sheep and goats, is that done? Has that been decided?
Yeah, they did. The board took no action on a proposal to remove sheep and goats from the clean list within, I think it's 15 miles of known wild sheep habitat. And they basically instructed the Farm Bureau, the producers, and this Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation proposing this measure to work together for the next year and try to figure out a way to protect Alaska's wild goats and sheep, muskox, without resorting to the kind of draconian measure that, the producers were arguing that taking these animals off the clean list and then requiring a permit would essentially destroy the sheep and goat industry in Alaska, because it would be almost impossible to get a permit once they weren't on the clean list.
Okay.
So a sigh of relief for goat and sheep producers. Of which there are many. This was a very, very contentious issue before the board got the most public comments of anything, and they received almost 1,000 public comments overall.
Oh.
On all issues, which is, I believe, more than they've received before.
Okay. And just as a side note, I know that there have been some reports about the number, as the population of the state of Alaska has grown a bit, leveling off at the moment, but over the years, the number of hunters in Alaska has increased rather dramatically, which has not been the case in the rest of the country. So we are an outlier, and I saw a number that suggested something in the neighborhood of 100,000 hunters in Alaska, and up from 10 or 20 years ago. On a continuing increase. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about in other places about hunting and the difficulty people have in finding places to hunt, but the end result being a decline in the number of hunters. So we remain somewhat different when we're trying to make comparisons on anything, whether we're talking about feral cats or sheep and goats and all the rest of that. So just throw that in the mix, too. Well,
for sure.
I know, Zanz, you have been not only watching this Fish and Game and all the discussion there, but also you recently did an article which I bring up at the present time because it's in the mix of a rather large, complicated question regarding how to deal with crime in the Valley. We've witnessed a legislature which has its houses divided, so to speak, where after a long bit of work, many listeners know that a revision of the criminal justice system really was put in place with SB 91. There was some pushback on elements, and we had a lot of work done in the special session dealing with SB 54. And then we ran into a kind of a standoff between the House and the Senate about really fixing a couple of technical issues and the rest of it. And I might throw in here also, as introduction to what I'm going to ask you, we had Emily Forstner do a good journalist who did some interviewing with people, including the City of Palmer's police chief and the mayor of Wasilla and lieutenant from the troopers and Senator Dunleavy, and was looking at the issue from the standpoint of how those people looked at crime and the kinds of things that individuals might want to do. But the reason why I give all that lead up is because your article followed a trial which in part was looking at an individual, but was also looking at the system and some perhaps failures on the system, whether it's SB 91 type or not. How about summarizing that?
Yeah, this was a horrible story, a court story. And this was a story that had a lot of public interest when it happened. And it was a woman who we are naming because we have permission from the family. She's been named in our paper and other media, but she's a sexual assault victim. And her name's Shauna Robb, and she was basically attacked by someone she knew from work at a restaurant here in the Valley. And they knew each other from work. He came to her house and broke in through a dog door and attacked her at her house, was arrested for that incident in which he brought in a 9mm pistol and hit her on the head with it, and was charged with that and was placed in third-party custody, which is really standard. And so a judge basically determines that someone, a friend of yours, your parents, other relatives, are, meet various background check requirements and commit to, in court, commit to keeping you under 24/7 monitoring to make sure that you don't reoffend, to make sure you don't violate the conditions of your release. And so Jordan King, the defendant in this case, was in the third-party custody of his mom and his stepdad and his grandmother. And he started being a problem for them. So the stepdad said, and this is all playing out the last 2 weeks, there's been a criminal trial in Palmer Superior Court in Judge White's courtroom. And this case is now to the jury. There may be a verdict this morning. Jordan, as his stepdad got ready, so his stepdad called the 911 and said, look, I can't handle him anymore. Can you come get him? And the trooper said, no, you need to bring him in yourself. You need to remand him yourself. And he got ready to do that. And in the meantime, his stepson must have kind of figured out what was going on, and he left. He had apparently developed a fairly elaborate, prosecutors say he developed a fairly elaborate plan to return to Shauna Robb's house and kidnap her. And perhaps the question here, and one of the biggest, and maybe the only difficult decision that this jury has, is whether he should be charged with attempted murder. But it was a really horrific crime. She spent 12 hours bound and led around the forest, kind of in the Pittman Road area. He stole her truck, put her in the back, and took her out there, and sexually assaulted her twice, she said. And so the problem is, when the stepdad called the second time to report his stepson gone, no one notified his victim, Shauna Robb. And so she didn't know when she went out to start her car at 4:30 in the morning that he might be out there, which is what happened. He had a knife with him, and that's when he abducted her. And so her family blames the state for that second attack, that should not have happened in their eyes. And the whole situation is, you know, on its face horrible, but also points out a fairly profound problem with victim notification in the pretrial process. And so the state is, regardless of what happens with SB 91, at least right now, is still planning to roll out this pretrial unit that was a fairly significant part of SB 91. And so this would be, I think there's 60 new staff, a tremendous upstaffing of people who monitor people like Jordan King who are released. They aren't in jail. They're out in the public. Maybe they're on ankle monitors or, you know, this kind of house arrest. And they have regular visits with somebody who just keeps an eye on them. I think the presumption is the family has someone that they deal with directly. But it's, and they also kind of gauge a person's likelihood to reoffend. It's unclear. The state sort of, I think, would like to say that that kind of unit would have helped in this situation. But he might not have been, I believe he has a clean record, so he may not have been deemed a big risk. So there still remains a kind of that victim notification question mark. You know, this whole thing happened. He left his parents' custody at 8 o'clock at night. So if you call the court, there's nobody there. If you call the DA's office, there's nobody there. And so, you know, calling 911, I think he figured that at least there's always someone there. And the troopers did open a case, but they apparently didn't go out looking for this guy and didn't notify the victim or the prosecutor until the next morning.
So I guess the real question is whether was there some deficiency, given the system in place at the present time, was there someone who was could have or should have done something and didn't? Or is the system so loose, as you've described it, that until the changes happen, you might see this kind of thing played out again?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it hasn't happened before just without such serious or at least public consequences. But yeah, I mean, the call comes into a 911 dispatcher and she notifies troopers and they open a case. You know, they were not required to go pick up this kid when the stepdad called the first time. Although a lawyer for the family points out, Josh Fannin, who's well known in the Valley, criminal defense attorney, that often when judges are signing off on third party custodians, they say, look, you don't have to jeopardize your own safety. If this person becomes a threat to you, call 911, call the troopers. And so it's certainly the victim isn't blaming the stepdad and the mom and the grandmom, that they did what they were supposed to do. But yeah, Mike, it does seem like, I mean, the troopers, as far as I could tell, were not required to notify, but maybe it's a kind of situation where, you know, if you call the right person, if the right trooper is working, oh, I know that case, we better notify the victim, let me call a prosecutor. But there's no requirement. So, you know, it certainly seems on its face that the troopers should have taken that extra step, but I think at this point it is an extra step because it's not a required one.
Okay, Mark?
Yeah, I'm not clear yet. How would anything have been different procedurally pre-SB 91?
There is some question about what went into effect when and whether his violating his conditions of release would have qualified as, you know, what kind of a procedure that would have triggered in terms of like an immediate bail hearing, or if that would then be a violation, a ticket, basically, instead of a misdemeanor. But the victim's notification piece is kind of separate from that.
Interesting. Is there any talk of what was the issue, why he chose her? Did he have an issue with her, or was it just random?
Yeah, they'd had a brief prior relationship, and he wanted her back, it sounds like.
Okay.
And she did not want to go back.
Okay. Well, and of course, this is one of those, I don't know how to place it in the present circumstance of a national furor that has arisen, where harassment of one sort, this is an egregious, this is way beyond, but it still fits within, I think, a category of having someone say no to a relationship and having the person mm-hmm. continue on. And I, well, I would hope that as we move forward, and once the settled what is changes have been made in 91, et cetera, that we get down to the real examples of what is in place, what is working, and continue putting a light on situations so that if other individuals have a concern about someone, they know who to call, when to call, what kind of response, what to do, rather than say, well, you'll just have to wait until morning because there's nobody in the office, which is a kind of a harsh response.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay.
And it's completely ineffective in a case like this.
Well, off in the distance, we can hear the drums of people who are actually drumming to different drummers. And I'm talking about taxes. There are people in the House, in the Congress, people in the Senate, who are trying to aim to have a tax bill passed before the end of the year. And most recently, what has become involved in that is a way to pay for a situation where you have fewer taxes by reducing the amount of money that would be required for health insurance. And so once again, arising from the ashes are the various repeal efforts for the Affordable Care Act or portions thereof. And it appears that that decision will be not made today in its complete form, but it's going to be worked out, and we'll be talking about it later. But it is something that will affect everyone. And once again, if you live in Alaska or if you live in Texas or you live in Florida, California, whatever happens in Washington may have a very different effect upon you. It's not one law that will affect everyone in the same way. And I think that's the concern that many people are having about any legislation that's passed. Is it even handed? Or in this case, does it dramatically provide a plus for some and a negative for others? So we'll be following that, but Mark, do you have anything or Zaz as an update to that?
I don't.
Yeah, I don't. I just wanted to express my disappointment at the completely off this topic and back to the other of the latest parade of both additional women who are accusing Moore and Al Franken.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And I've just watched a little bit this morning of some discussion about this and attempting to get a sense, since there are so many different people who have in their lives somewhere in the past done so many different things, mm-hmm. whether the approach where someone is accused, and I'm saying Franken and actually some others, have said, yes, I'm not denying that happened. I apologize, and I'm wanting to go forward, and if we want to investigate and do more with this, yes. Versus a situation where there are some people who have said, no, that never happened, they're lying. And that seems to be a dividing line. Now, given that in many of these cases, there still hasn't been a trial, so that you have a kind of an investigation and a trial and a determination of perhaps whose memory is better or what actually happened. I've noticed that there's been a lot of move toward condemnation for many different people on the basis of the accusation. And Zaz in particular, I'm struck by that. I'm not saying I don't believe. Especially when you have a series of people coming forth who are making statements that about one individual over time. But what's your sense about that?
It's always fraught to be dealing with accusations without the credibility of a judicial process. In the case of the guy who sort of opened this can of worms, Harvey Weinstein, he has continued to deny, but is up against really similar ongoing stories from dozens of women. I think that really, you know, I think the same thing happened with Bill Cosby, who was what? There was a hung jury. I can't remember what the outcome was, but he was not convicted, despite having all these women with very similar stories. And so, yeah, I mean, it's journalistically, it's problematic. But I think that it's also because, you know, when these accusations, I mean, Al Franken, for example, his accuser is saying what he forced a kiss on her and then took a picture of her while she was sleeping and making it look like he was fondling her. Well, we can see the picture. The picture's out there, and it's stupid. I mean, why would he do that? But he did that, you know. It's, you know, he's a funny guy, and maybe it was a prank. But in the context that we're looking at harassment now, it certainly doesn't look good. So, but yeah, no, it is very complicated, and I, you know, we need to be careful.
Yep. Okay. Well, let us be careful as we're finishing up this edition of Valley Edition by offering something in a positive light. Question to both of you. Thanksgiving is coming up. We have all enjoyed many Thanksgivings and probably have had different food at all of these Thanksgivings. Of all of them, what is the most important thing that you like to eat or provide on the table for Thanksgiving? Let's start with Mark, who looks like he's got the answer.
Well, yeah, here's a Thanksgiving tip I found a couple years ago, and, you know, it's hard for me to imagine I would ever turn away from this. I used to cook a whole turkey, and I enjoyed cooking a whole turkey. But let's face it, it takes time. It's hard to cook the whole thing evenly. So a couple years ago, I bought just a turkey breast. And I seasoned it with sage, stuffed it with some citrus, some orange and lemon, and cooked that up way better. You don't have quite the leftovers, but all the meat is cooked evenly, and it allows for a second dish for folks who don't love turkey. You can do a rib roast or whatever. So that is my tip for all out there who find the task of a whole turkey daunting.
Okay, Zaz.
I'm going to have to go with my cranberries.
Your cranberries.
Short and sweet. Yeah, my cranberries. And occasionally I'm actually bringing my cranberries over to a friend's house. I'm cooking dinner over here. And we'll have a turkey and a non-turkey option for the vegan among us. But he's going to have to watch us eat the turkey. But the cranberry dish is actually, I'm making double to bring over to a friend's house because the cranberries there are, and they may be listening, they know who they are inedibly sour. And so my cranberries kind of smooth out. You have to eat my cranberries with that other person's cranberries to make them palatable. So my cranberries save the day at someone else's Thanksgiving dinner.
Okay. Well, wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that. And for me, I like simply variety, all the different things. And that's what, and I won't even try to list them all at this point. But I want to thank Zaz Hollander. Thank you for being on the air today.
Thank you, Mike. And I hope everybody has a happy Thanksgiving and has all the food they need.
All right. And Mark, thank you too.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Okay, we've come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. And we'll be back to tell you the rest of the story. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.